Think big. Think positive. Never show any sign of weakness. Always go for the throat. Buy low, sell high. Fear, that's the other guy's problem. Nothing you have ever experienced can prepare you for the unbridled carnage you're about to witness. Right. Super Bowl, the World Series, they don't know what pressure is. In this building, it's either kill or be killed. Right. You make no friends in the pits and you take no prisoners.
No prisoners.
1 minute, you're up half a million in soybeans, and the next, boom, your kids don't go to college and they've repossessed your Bentley. Are you with me?
Hello and welcome to Turner's Take Podcast. I'm your host, Craig Turner, author of Turner's Take Newsletter. I am a broker and commodity risk manager at StoneX. I work in the ag markets, dairy, work with hedgers, producers, corporate end users, do anything from futures and options to OTC, also consulting and research. I actually personally have a hand in all of those. If you have any questions for me about the commodity markets, you can contact me at the office at 312-706-7610. You can also email craig.turner@stonex.com. Now, if you Google me, Craig Turner at StoneX, all my contact information comes up anyways. And all my information's in the show notes for the podcast. If you are a client and like what you hear, you want to add on to a position, you need to make some adjustments, do something differently, give me a call. If you're not a client here and like to learn more about what it's like to work with us, feel free to call or email anytime. So let's get into it. I have been in and out of the office for a little while here, but I'm going to be back for a while now. Let's talk about the macro markets first. Some jitters going on with the Fed talking about tapering and raising interest rates. Here's the thing with the Fed. They have a dual mandate. They have a mandate to make sure that employment is at a reasonable level, meaning that unemployment rates are low. And their second mandate is to make sure inflation doesn't get out of check. One, I guess on the inflation front, primarily don't go into deflation. And then secondary, don't let inflation run rampant, right? So those are the dual mandates of the Fed. And if you take a look at the employment rate, I know those, you can make arguments on how those numbers are calculated, but you're just looking at the numbers and unemployment is low. And then you take a look at inflation. Inflation's getting to be a bit of a concern, and rightfully so. So I do think the Fed, and I'm not surprised that the Fed is getting more aggressive about talking about interest rate hikes slowly, but definitely going up, and also talking about tapering. And you might be saying, well, what exactly is tapering? You hear this term. Here's the deal. When the economy overheats and they're worried about booms and busts, or really, a boom and bust situation, and interest rates, they raise interest rates to kind of slow down the economy. And people say, why would you want to do that? Well, prior to the Great Depression, prior to the Roaring Twenties, believe it or not, and Great Depression, there was no controls. There really wasn't a whole lot of controls. The Fed was active, in some ways during the Roaring Twenties. The booms and busts we saw from, let's say, the start of the country up until 1900, up until World War One, were epic. I mean, you look at a chart of the inflation and deflation. I'll try to post it from 1650. We're talking, within a two decade periods of 40% inflation, 10% deflation. I mean, crazy numbers. And then it isn't until the Federal Reserve really gets involved in policy, right? And which is stemming from, probably didn't do too much during the Roaring Twenties and made the wrong moves in the Depression. And when you really look at the economics at all, odds are the Federal Reserve probably prolonged, and some of the policies coming out of Washington probably prolonged the Depression probably 3 or 4 years longer than needed to be. And after the Fed sees all that stuff, after World War II, you get this controlled economy of where if economy gets too high, they increase interest rates to slow down growth to prevent the big crash. and deflationary pressures that can come with it. And when the market is getting too low and it's going to be, it, you know, could go into a depression, they make money available and interest rates come down. So we're at a point now, long story short, I know that was kind of long-winded there, but the whole point is the Fed does have, I mean, the Fed has done a decent job compared to in the past 80 to 90 years with monetary policy. So what they'll probably, and then, all right, and then the tapering. So between, let's say, the Roaring Twenties and Great Depression and the subprime crisis, what the Fed mostly just did was tinker around with interest rates. After the subprime crisis and also the COVID crisis, interest rate changes weren't enough. So what they, to provide liquidity and keep interest rates down, the Fed bought assets, whether it be mortgage-backed securities, corporate debt, whatever, you know, treasuries, whatever it may be, and then they held it and just let it mature. And then when those bonds mature, the people, the government, get the money back. But for, you know, that period of time where they're buying 2-year notes or 5-year, 10-year, 30-year mortgage-backed securities, basically they're fronting the payment and providing support. Tapering means they're just not going to start, they're not going to buy as many and eventually won't buy any at all. Now they're going to sell them. They'll just let them live its natural life. And the Fed collects a coupon payment. And at the end of the term, they collect all the money, right? So if it's a $1 million bond, they buy at 3%. It's the Fed collecting that money. And then at the end of the bond, they get the full principal. And in theory, it goes to the government, goes to the people. And that's how that works. So the first thing they'll do is they'll do the tapering. They'll stop buying as much as this debt to eventually zero and let the debt just start retiring. And then they'll have interest rates go up. And hopefully, I mean, the goal here is, you know, we stop getting these subprime and subprime and COVID crisis. And we can eventually just go back to a monetary policy with the Fed where we're just tinkering with interest rates and you don't have to bring out the big bazooka of the tapering. So we are seeing the 10-year and 30-year interest rates go up, meaning those bond prices are coming down. So if you look at a price of them on the futures chart, the prices will come down, but that means the interest rates are going up in expectation of that. That will put strengthen in the dollar and that will help or begin to help fight a little bit of the inflation pressures because of all the money that's going around, or at least cheap money. So that is where we are on, I think, it's pretty much where we are on the macro markets. Just something to keep in mind with the Fed, with interest rates, bond yields, inflation. They're all connected, and there is going to be some kind of attempt to slow the economy down a little bit, not so much because, now I think it has more to do with just the fact that they have to stop providing all this money because they're seeing the effects of inflation now, which are becoming. Now, some inflation is because, and over time is because, you know, when you print money and you have debt and there is going to be inflation just from that. There's also inflation. And I don't need to get into Professor Pipe, economist professor at my days at NYU, where I was a student in my MBA. But, you know, there is this theory, and I wouldn't even call it a theory at this point. It's probably, you know, what happens is as the world gets richer and we have greater improvements in technology, there's more of an abundance, efficiencies. There is more money and wealth that goes around, which creates a higher demand for goods and services, which naturally increase prices anyway. And even though it increases prices, it also increases standards of living, right? So there is, it's not as black and white about inflation is mostly bad, but there are some good things that come out of it because there are other good things going on with basically the development of wealth throughout the world and living standards. All right. I don't want to get too deep into that rabbit hole, but what I will say is, hold on. What I will say is there's some supply and demand pressures also. Like natural gas is a perfect example. Now, natural gas here has gone from $2 to $3 to $6 in the United States. We've doubled. Part of that can be a little bit of inflation, but a lot of it is supply and demand. We are having a supply crunch. We've been on low supply for a while, and even though we used to have so much natural gas, we didn't know what to do with it. We cut back on production. We've also cut back on some other energy sources that we don't use as much anymore, creating more demand. Coal's not, I mean, long story short, coal. We don't use coal as much as we used to. And, while we had huge deposits of natural gas coming off of coal, that eventually catches up to you. And then you come into the slowdown of COVID, the slowdown of production during that time. And now that the economy is coming back and we're heading into the winter, we're finding ourselves, not just the United States, the rest of the world, low on natural gas supplies. Part of that is just policy. I mean, the biggest culprit on the policy side is for the higher energy prices is just not utilizing coal, which is part of the Green Initiative, which is fine if you can make up for that energy source. Like if you're going to say, if the government says, okay, we're going to be more green energy, we're going to make all this investment, great. Eventually that green energy will take the place of what we're using now. I think what fortunately has happened is we're not using as much coal because of policy, and we haven't been able to make it up in the cleaner energy sources. And really the big demand to meet that deficit is in the natural gas market. So we're seeing around the world too a natural gas deficit. Now production had been lower because of COVID, and the market had got caught off guard on how fierce the recovery has been globally and in the United States on a percentage basis from where we were last year. So there's a, you know, no one is, I wouldn't say one specific point is to blame, but they're all kind of helping right now. Some of them are beyond our control. Some of them we kind of shot ourselves in the foot, but that's just the way it is. And so we're seeing prices of natural gas in Britain, like the equivalent of $25 here. It has gone up almost 500%. I think, and we're only in September, like September, it's late September here. These should be mild weather mark months when we're building in supplies. We're having a higher injection rate into the supplies than there is demand going out. And we're just not nearly where we need to be. If we have a cold winter, we have a prolonged winter, there's a real concern about how tight the market can get. So, and what that means for prices. I mean, in Britain now, we've had fertilizer plants close, also in Norway, because either the price is just so high, the companies can't take the risk or can't find a buyer. But what really is the issue is that'd be secondary. The primary issue is that the availability, they can't get it. I mean, there's a reason why natural gas in Britain went from five to, from 6 to 25 or something like that. It's just not available. I look at, if you could take a look at a price of urea, which is a pretty big fertilizer out there for those of you who aren't, in the farmers who are listening to this podcast. We were trading around 300 in April. We're about 450 in July, August, and now we're above 600. So the price of that fertilizer has doubled. Doubled. And the thing is, if you're asking yourself, what's the connection? I just made the assumption that you would know. I apologize about that. For a lot of fertilizers, natural gas can make up 60 to 80% of the cost. So, and the higher the natural gas price gets, the more the cost it is. I want to say when natural gas was back in like 06, 07, 08, I have to take a look at a long-term natural gas chart. We did used to trade between like $6 and $14, which I know is high, but natural gas lived a lot of times, like in those low tens, like 9, 10, 11, 12. Dollar range, especially during those peak years. We used to call natural gas the widowmaker, that and silver when they were highly volatile. So I know if you look at a 10-year chart, like, well, $6, we haven't really been much above $10. I mean, $6 over the past 10 years. Well, go back another 10 years and you can see how crazy natural gas really got over those years. So when we, so, and then you have to say to yourself, well, two things. One, energy costs, right? And do you have energy costs? And do you want to hedge them or speculate on them? I think the way to play the natural gas market is it's very volatile. You almost want to be buying call spreads and selling put spreads, I think. And I think when you look at December, January, and February, you know, for the end users out there, for the producers, you know, you probably either buy futures and buy a put, or you lock in that cash, you know, you actually lock in, you know, forward contract, or you contract the natural gas and you buy a put, just in case prices collapse, because you want to be a competitive advantage. Or if you know you have to buy the energy later on in the year and you don't want to outlay all that now, or you want to have the potential for lower prices if you need to buy that energy, probably look into the call market, right? To just, as in kind of like an insurance play in case the thing really takes off. But that is definitely something that's been on our radar, and it's going to be, you know, more on our radar going forward. And it is going to be a very volatile market. So, and it not just doesn't affect energy, it affects agriculture, which is a good segue here into the last third of this podcast. My concern about natural gas is how high priced fertilizer will be. And if there's a huge shortage of it, for even if it's a short period of time, not only will fertilizer prices be higher because input prices are more, fertilizer prices might be higher on top of that because just the availability. You know, we're talking about a world with high grain prices that's going to demand a lot more acres, right? To get back to normal supply and demand levels. There's an old saying, high prices cure high prices, because what does it do? Brings out all the acres, and you plant all the corn and all the soybeans and all the wheat, and you go from basically tight stocks to abundant to burdensome stocks, right? And you get all that grain, and then, you know, you're kind of at certain price levels for a few years until prices get too low. And then we have a saying, low prices cure low prices. You know, there's either a production issue or unexpected demand, and you get caught off guard, and a weather issue, and before you know it, you're off to the races again. For those of us that have been involved in these markets for a long time, know the drill. But that's how it works in the commodity markets. It's much more cyclical, not just within the year, but also in a span of 5 or 10 years. There's, you know, because of that. What does that mean for for acres? Like, if fertilizer is hard to come by, if fertilizer is very expensive, what does that mean for the corn acres we'll see? Or, you know, if we were planning on 94 million acres of corn and fertilizer is A, hard to come by, well, you know, do you plant and then just use less of it? Or do you not plant at all? So either acres come down because you can't get the inputs that you need, or acres stay the same and there's not enough of it and yields come down because you can't use the growing program that you want to, right? So it's kind of a little bit of a double whammy there. And what does it also mean for the rest of the world? The United States, like the United States is probably in the best position to handle higher input costs compared to South America and Ukraine and other parts of the world. So that's going to be interesting too. And also, as a broker, who works on the commercial side, you know, not everyone is hedged. I think these kind of for that, and meaning they, you know, maybe not either bought enough fertilizer or bought enough natural gas as hedges. And these things can happen fast. Like if you look at the price of natural gas and what's happened very quickly, and also at the price of fertilizer, what's very quickly, it's easy to catch people off guard. And now the question is, what do you do? Personally, the big companies that I work with, what the idea has been, you lock in this input cost now because no one knows what's going to happen in October, November, December, January. My concern is availability. And then you buy a put. And then if the market completely crashes, you make up almost, you know, most of that money. You know, so if you did have high input costs, let's say in natural gas or in fertilizer, you would make that back, or a big chunk of it. So you're not at a competitive disadvantage. But I think you got to lock it in now, because the other case of it just going sky high and not being available is almost even worse, I think, or in my perspective, it is. I'm sure we can get some arguments the other side of that. So I think that's what you'll start to see more. On the producer side, like for the farmer, my concern isn't a drop in grain prices right now. Quite the contrary. I think the prices could probably go higher here. But my concern would be fertilizer. I know a lot of guys lock stuff in early, and I think you have to. If you need to hedge this stuff a little bit, you can hedge it in the futures and OTC market. You can always have a little bit of a play in natural gas because natural gas prices are so linked to fertilizer. You can, you know, come up with a pretty good hedge that way too. But I don't know. It's just something to consider. So corn, wheat, and soybeans, we're going to have stocks tomorrow. The yield reports I'm hearing have been mixed at best. We're not hearing as good as yields we need out of the Eastern Corn Belt, but we'll say this, in the plains, yields are a little bit better than feared. So, you know, there was this argument that the Eastern Corn Belt had to have record yields to make up for all the losses in the Northwest part of the Midwest and also the Northern Plains. I don't know. It's, excuse me, a little bit disappointing out east, a little bit better than expected up north and out west. So maybe that evens out. Regardless, I still think we're at a 1.4, 1.3 carryout on corn. We're still coming into this year tight. Canada's still going to have to import grain, unfortunately for them. Just, you know, for the farmers up there, the barley crop, the canola crop, the oat crop, it's the spring wheat crop. It's just not good. I think Canada overall is going to lose probably 30 to 35% of, you know, when you add up all their grain and oil seed production, they're going to probably be off by 30 to 35%. That's a huge, huge number to be down at, you know, on agriculture. And they're going to have to end up importing feed from the United States. And I don't think that's reflected on the balance sheet yet. So things will be tight. Bean oil is another. I mean, I've been talking about bean oil for a while. I haven't even touched on it. We're 20 minutes into this podcast. I haven't talked about biodiesel and soybean oil. Meanwhile, that was the main theme of a lot of these podcasts and newsletters for the past couple of months. But it just goes to show how things have kind of changed. And I'm still a bean oil and biodiesel proponent. But it's also if natural. The one problem with bean oil and biodiesel is the government can change mandates, right? And I think that's what kind of keeps the bean oil prices in check right now. But, you know, the administration is dedicated to clean energy. The one thing that may slow that down is if natural gas prices really take off in it. And we get into a big energy crisis or crunch. Let's say we get into an energy crunch and just prices are high this winter, it could be an issue where the administration backs off a little bit on the mandates. I could see that, still keep prices high, but it is something to keep in mind. So for the bean oil, I like buying call spreads, selling put spreads. If we're going to be buying futures, buy a put. And it's because you have to be respectful of the downside if something happens with the mandates, right? That would be a big deal. So that's how I would go about that. Wheat's going to be tight all year. There's going to be find a lot of support on the breaks, and corn probably has a lot of support right at five or below. If we're going to be about a 1.5 billion carryout with the potential fertilizer issue hanging over us for the next production year. So seems somewhat bullish, I think, in all the grain markets. If I'm a farmer, I'm probably even trying to buy back sales a little bit heading here into the winter in case we get a La Nina, with, you know, probably buying futures and buying a put for protection. If I'm looking for something to sell into, if I'm a farmer, you know, you can probably buy $6 calls in March corn and sell a put spread and cover most of the, that's, you know, cover most of it, that kind of thing, and then sell cash into it. And if I'm an end user, I'm trying to lock in as much as possible. And then if I'm worried about the inputs going down, I'm probably just buying a put, so I'm not at a competitive disadvantage with the other companies I have to compete with in the marketplace. And that's probably where we are. So if you're in any of those categories, You have any questions about what we're doing, whether it be on the producer side, the end user side, farmer or commercial, or if you're a spec trader here in the ag and energy markets, give me a call. Let me know what you're thinking, and good luck for the rest of the week. I'll be sending out an email newsletter later today. And it is one last thing before I go. It is getting into speaking seasons, especially after harvest break. So if I'll be doing talks in, October through March, if you want me to come and speak to your company or come to your event, please let me know. All my contact information is in the show notes. Have a great week, everyone, and I'll talk to you soon.
This material is conveyed as a solicitation for entering into a derivatives transaction. This material has been prepared by a Daniel's Trading Broker who provides research market commentary and trade recommendations as part of his or her solicitation for accounts and solicitation for trades. Daniel's Trading, its principals, brokers, and employees may trade in derivatives for their own accounts or for the accounts of others. Due to various factors such as risk tolerance, margin requirements, trading objectives, short-term versus long-term strategies, technical versus fundamental market analysis, and other factors, such trading may result in the initiation or liquidation of positions that are different from or contrary to the opinions and recommendations contained therein. Past performance is not necessarily indicative of future performance. The risk of loss in trading futures contracts or commodity options can be substantial, and therefore investors should understand the risks involved in taking leveraged positions and must assume responsibility for the risks associated with such investments and for their results. You should carefully consider whether such trading is suitable for you in light of your circumstances and financial resources. You should read the risk disclosure accessed at www.danielstrading.com. Daniel's Trading is not affiliated with, nor does it endorse any trading system, newsletter, or similar service. Daniel's Trading does not guarantee or verify any performance claims made by such systems or services.